Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives. Shirley Conran is very modern. She is a great believer in women. Maybe this comes from her years as a single mother or a working mother, or as the home editor for The Mail, who created Female, or the first woman's editor of Observer magazine. She really is most famous in the public eye for two of her 11 books, that is Superwoman and the glamorous bonk buster Lace. Shirley Conran, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
It's wonderful to be on a radio with such a wonderful name.
So Shirley, I've met you in an important time in your life as you've just released another book. No normal paper book for you. This is an app, kind of e-book, which you download, and it's called Money Stuff, and it's for women. And the motto is, life is too short to be short of money.
Yes, something that I firmly believe. And also there are a lot of other things. What Money Stuff does really is relate maths to money. And I started it because I looked around and I thought, women haven't got enough money. And then I spent 10 years researching this book and preparing it. And during that time, I asked a lot of women at all different income stages, would you like more money? And they all said no, without exception. And I said, are you sure? So they all said, well, I'd like a little bit more, or words to that effect. And they were obviously only thinking in terms of a new kitchen or a home extension, whereas I wanted them to think in terms of a new house, a new car, a new career. Also, you can do a lot of good with money. I've been involved with a lot of voluntary work, and I find that if somebody doesn't want to do something and the committee doesn't want to do it, then I just go off and do it by myself and pay for it, and it gets done. So I'm considered a bit of a maverick, but, I mean, the proof of the pudding is whether it gets done or not. And I was talking with the Minister for Women yesterday, Nikki Morgan, and one of the things I said to her was, I think that all childcare should be entirely tax deductible. And she said, well, we're working on it, and gave me details. But also their main aim is to lift people out of making any tax returns whatsoever. And I think that's so clever of them, because I shouldn't dream of doing my own tax return. I'm afraid I subcontracted out to an accountant.
So tell me about this book. Who's it aimed at?
Well, we tested it. It's been tested. It's a maths course, but it relates to real life. You know, what you pay for a pair of shoes, what you pay for a loaf of bread, how you can sort out your energy offers, how you can check on your credit card bills for interest. It goes right from the beginning, plus and minus, up to compound multiplication. And it goes at your own level because, you know, when you don't want to do any more, you just put it to bed. But I think the thing is, it's interactive. And it doesn't need a teacher. And I think I would say that you mentioned earlier my book Superwoman, which was about how to minimise your housework. This is about how to minimise your maths, but everything in it you need to make a success in life, I think, whether you're working outside the home or in it. And, of course, if you're rich, people think you don't have to look after your own money. Well, it goes pretty quickly if you don't. And if you're poor, it's even more important to look after every penny and make sure that you're getting the best deal and you're not being cheated. So it's a very personal book. I mean, as you said, it's an e-book, it's an interactive e-book, and I've designed the whole thing as well as the words. It's absolutely crammed with illustrations. There are over 1,000 illustrations, and I like to think Vogue-level photographs. And because I was not good at maths at school, and as soon as I got into business, or as soon as I grew up, actually, I found I needed it. And I think in these days of the computer, it's even more important, because the computer's always right. But if the computer's wrongly programmed, if somebody's little finger hesitates too long on a naught, you get a bill for £1,200 instead of £120. And also, banks aren't very good. You think that the banks are efficient. I have not found it to be so. Usually mistakes are never in my favour, I find. But there was once when it was, because I'd opened my bank statement and I found it read 1,900,000 and a few bits, you know.
Sounds
and
good.
I sat looking at it for a bit because I knew they'd made a mistake. But I didn't tell them for about a week because I so enjoyed it. I didn't tell them for a fortnight, and the bank didn't notice, and the person the money belonged to didn't notice.
So literally they'd moved it from the wrong account.
They'd put it into my account, which was the wrong account, sadly. Yes. Yeah. they then said, oh, you should have told us sooner, and whipped it all away again. Did I get a bottle of champagne? Did I get a letter of thanks? No.
No, you should have got a percentage for having the money in your account. Yeah, exactly. You're saying it is visual. It does look like a magazine, doesn't it?
I started a magazine on The Observer. I was one of the starters of the magazine. With a group of other people, headed by Laudrey Slaughter, also started a magazine called Over 21. We called it Over 21 because we really wanted 16-year-olds to read it.
Yes.
And we sold out 18 months later and made 8,000% profit.
Wow.
So I know what it's like. Mm. But I also know what it's like to have lost money, and I didn't learn how to do bookkeeping until I was 50. And as soon as I did, all the leaking of my money stopped because I could track it immediately.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So how do we access it? I just want to know, so people listening, if they want to buy it for themselves, for their daughter, for their granddaughter, how do they access it?
You'll need an iPad, and that costs £250, whether you buy a mini iPad or a maxi one. I've been buying rather a lot, as you can imagine. And then you go to the iBookstore, and it's one of the especially recommended books, and it's called Money Stuff. And you can get the first one free till the end of July. And there are four books in it. And the others cost £4.99 each. And by some miracle of mathematics, iStore charges £14.99 for the complete set. And I think, you know, in terms of maths and in terms of money, that's a very good investment of your time. And if you think, oh, I'm not going to buy an iPad, well, it's a better investment than an iBox, which costs more, mm-hmm. and the game, which costs a lot more. And people do find that doing money stuff is fun.
I think you can also, Shirley, because I think I downloaded it on my computer, computer, so
yeah.
I think you can do that as well.
You can, you're quite right.
Okay, so that's really good. So you can do it on your computer or your tablet. And it's a bargain price. And just think what you're going to get out of it. But also, you've made it a fun experience, haven't you?
Also, because we've tested it on from 13-year-old women, if I can call them that, to 70-year-old women and all the ages in between. We did a very good test at Langley Park School for Girls, which has 1,600 pupils. Wow. And we also tested it at Loughborough University. And some young men sneaked in there and did it under false pretences. And they enjoyed it as well.
Superb.
So it's just a new way of learning. I'm interested in not how people should learn or how they ought to learn. All the maths books are absolutely terrible. I went into a bookshop hoping to buy some and crib from them, you know, as every good journalist does, and I found they were all porridge. They were all so badly written that I think mostly if a person thinks they're no good at maths, they're wrong. They've been badly taught out of bad books. Mm. And science supports me in this because only 3% of people actually cannot see maths, cannot do maths. And strangely enough, only 3% of people are unusually good at it. So that leaves, if I'm not mistaken, 94% in between. And I'm sure most of your readers will be included in that, who are potentially good at maths.
Exactly. It's so interesting. Now, you've done so many things solely for women in your life. Let's look at your life and see where this zeal for equality and self-reliance started.
With my divorce.
Right.
I immediately found out, to my astonishment, that male judges didn't know what a pair of shoes cost for children, or an overcoat, or jam. And I also found that the law seemed absolutely slanted in favour of the husband. And I was really one of the first wave of women to get divorced.
I was going to say that it was very early, 1962?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I mean, that is early. I mean, it must have been quite shocking for your family, for your friends.
Yes.
I mean, was it unusual?
My mother said, well, perhaps it's just as well that your father's dead because otherwise you wouldn't have been able to get divorced.
Yeah.
I was 32 at the time. So that's
young.
How it was seen.
Just think how young that is
yeah.
now.
Yes, now that I'm 81, it does seem very young.
I suppose you hadn't really thought about it until you suddenly were a lone parent with two children and you had to do something about it.
Yes, and also my husband paid for the schooling, for which I'm very grateful, but I had to pay for everything else. And my mother looked after them for 2 years at Portsmouth, where she lived, and I would go down at weekends, and earning money became very real at that point because, children need food. Children are very, very expensive indeed. The latest figures say that to raise a child costs £220,000. That is, if it's not going to university. If it's going to university, you can add on another £50,000. So I think people should not really have children unless they're prepared, not only to bring them up properly, but also they have to understand how much they're going to cost in terms of money and in terms of time. And I think too many young girls are going to having a child these days because they just took a chance, and then they only see it in a rosy light. And I think it's time that young women were more practical about having children. I'm not against having children, you understand. I just think you should know what you're in for.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
Yeah, no one tells you that, do they? No. Until you're pregnant, I find.
No, I find they don't tell you when you're pregnant. They tell you after you've had the baby. And you say, my God, I never realised. You know,
I became a feminist overnight as soon as I gave birth because I suddenly realised I couldn't leave the house.
Yes.
But the man could always walk out the house.
Yes.
Because we have the ultimate responsibility, don't we?
Yes, and I think legally you're responsible for not leaving the child unattended until it's about 8 years old. I might be out of date on that legislation. It might be 18 for all I know now. But, parents are very much being called to account and expected to be good parents by school teachers and the government these days. And I'm all for that, really. Except I do not think that the school should rely on the parent, i.e. the mother, to do the homework or help with the homework. You know, the point of homework is so that the child learns to work alone and not that the mother has this torturous time of trying to do modern maths. But Money Stuff was actually tested by the Mum's Maths Club in Barnes. This was because a group of mothers outside the school gates had decided to club together to hire their maths teacher of the school to teach them maths so that they could help their children with their homework. So I said, don't do that. Test Money Stuff instead. And we've also tested it on children who are bedbound, 13-year-old girls, long-term, and we've had very good results on that as
well.
Lovely.
God, it's so brilliant. So you were born in Hendon. Your father, I read in Superwoman, I don't know whether it's right, you said he's a dry cleaner, but you went to private school, so he must have owned quite a few dry cleaners. Or did you get a scholarship?
No, he had factories, and he had dry cleaning chains.
Yeah.
He has been called a dry cleaning baron, which I'm sure would have amazed him. He was a dry cleaner, but as you say, I did mention it in Superwoman because there's a big area in Superwoman on stain removal.
Yes, there
and
is.
Naturally, I learnt that at my daddy's knee. And the Dry Cleaning Federation were very angry about it, and they phoned up and said, how dare you, imposter, pretend to be a dry cleaner's daughter? You'd have thought I was pretending to be a duke's daughter. And then I said, Thirlby Pierce, and they said, oh, yes.
Oh, they suddenly went quiet.
Yes.
So it was obviously a middle-class home. You were the firstborn of four children?
Six.
Wow.
Yeah. It was during the war that I grew up. When the war started, I was seven. I hastened to say the Second World War.
Yes.
I was seven, and so we kept on being evacuated to the country and then brought back. And my parents had terrible timing because whenever they brought us back, the raids started again over London, and whenever they sent us away, they stopped. But then I went to St Paul's Girls' School in Hammersmith when I was 10, and I think that was the formative time of my career because my father was an alcoholic, so not easy to live with. Wow. And I found I just loved being at school. It was so calm and reasonable and logical, and being in our house was rather like living in a tornado. You never knew what was going to happen next. So I shall always be grateful to St Paul's and to my mother for sending me there.
Did you have a fraught relationship with your dad?
We didn't have any relationship at all with our dad, you know. It was like living with an ogre in the attic. You know, the first words we would say to the maid, I would say, when I came back was, is Mummy in first? Yes. If she said no, Mummy wasn't in and Dad was in, I would go straight and hide under my bed. And that was age 14. But he was very, very generous in terms of money. And so my mother had whatever she wanted. And luckily, one of the things she wanted was to send us to very good schools. My grandmother was a headmistress of a little school in Cornwall, in Mevagissey. And I think you inherit an ability to teach because I think I have it. And I think that's the secret behind money stuff. I was also very proprietorial about it. I mean, when it came time to put it online and I needed an art editor, he lasted for about 2 weeks. And I saw that it was very important to use every bit of pictorial matter to underline the text and to show other aspects of what I was doing. So there's some very glamorous pictures in there.
It's the beauty of it. It's a magazine you can move with your finger and there's words on it to inspire you. And, you know, it's so clever. I mean, I've never seen anything like it.
I can give you all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
It was empirically built. It was empirically designed, which means that you build it on testing, 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 and if something's wrong, then you go the other way and try something else. It is in a way, but there are all reasons I could give you, because I trained as a designer, you see.
Yes.
I've got a fine arts background. But my son says, look, cut the crap, Mum. We know it's just instinctive in you.
Yeah.
So I think I got a particular gift for teenage girls, for instance, and women.
You fight for women, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think that the second wave of feminism that was in the early 70s, it was powered by all the women who got divorced in the 60s and were left with the baby under one arm, two more clutching at their skirts and their Laura Ashley dress, I need to say, and their recipe for homemade bread. All that was all they were left with. And I think that there were a lot of women in my position. And I ended up as being very much a part of the 70s feminist movement, and I was responsible for women in media for all publicity in Britain. The first wave of feminism was in 1860 in America. So really the suffragettes in Britain were the second wave, and what they wanted was very clear. They wanted the vote. What we wanted in 1970 was very clear. We wanted equality of pay and equality of opportunity. And we still haven't got equality of pay. The pay gap is actually widening. It's narrowing for people in jobs that don't pay much, but above that level, I'm afraid the gap is widening. And I think the feminists of today seem to me to be disorganised in that they are not well organised. The groups are not in touch with each other. There is no centre for communications that you can phone or email and who will say, oh, right, you're in County Durham, then your nearest centre is blah. And they also, I think, I very much disapprove of the feminist police. I would call them platinum Nazis because... because I think everybody should be a feminist in her own way. The first rule of feminism should be don't criticise other feminists, because everybody has to work things out in their own way, at their own time, and within their own ability.
And their situation.
And their situation.
That's so big,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
As I say, it's when it affects you is when you become conscious of it. You know, it's like,
yes.
It's hard to sell the idea unless it's affected you, I find, feminism, you know.
Feminism really is about being able to be independent if you want to be. And if you're in a family situation, then everybody is interdependent. But what you don't want to be is dependent, because that puts you in a terrible position.
It's exactly what happened to your mother then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. We used to wonder and ask her why she stayed with Daddy. And I think the real reason was that, well, she said without her, he would be dead in 2 years. Something she did tell me later on when she was much older was that she couldn't leave because of money.
Yeah.
As I said, my father was very generous, and what money came into his account was immediately, half of it was put into my mother's bank account.
Wow.
Now, I unfortunately thought that this was what marriage was like and that this was what happened. But as I said, I woke up after my divorce.
So you were married to Terence Conran. Was he successful then, or was it like the beginning when he was...
No, he was very successful then. He had, you know, he was, I think, driving an Alfa Romeo and generally could afford. He'd asked me if I wanted to move to a grander house, and I said no, I didn't. I like knew all the neighbours, my children had their friends there, but that's sort of indicative. He could have afforded to move into Belgravia if he'd wanted to.
Wow.
That's not under. I don't want to devalue what Terence has done, because he has done an absolutely fabulous job in the design field, not only in England, but internationally.
I mean, he literally revolutionised people's ways of living, didn't he?
Yes, he revolutionised the look of the home and the feel of the home. Mm-hmm. And he also, I think, made the home more creative once Terence came into it. You know, you could be creative about buying a teaspoon. Somebody once said to me, a journalist, before Terence Conran, you couldn't buy a plain teaspoon. I think that he gave people choice, but he also educated them through his various interests. And I think there hasn't been somebody so influential since William Morris in the late 19th century in that area. We're a family of designers.
So you went to St Paul's, then you studied sculpture.
Well, yeah, then I went to art college, and I had to take sculpture because that was the only place available. I really wanted to do painting, but there was only a place available in the sculpture class. Yeah. And I have not found sculpture much use to me, except that I can amaze my children by whacking a block of frozen spirit in half with one well done swipe of the chisel.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
Shirley Conran loves Radio Gorgeous. And they used to send me up on the roof to clear the ice in winter because I could chip it off. So I wouldn't recommend it as a career. But then I became design consultant to the Daily Mail.
Is that when you first ever wrote then?
Yes, that's when I wrote.
So you're a self-taught writer, totally.
I would say I was lucky enough to be taught at the Daily Mail. And that was a very tough school. And by the time you reach the Daily Mail, you're supposed to have done your years on provincial papers. So they were very tolerant of me at the Daily Mail, and they taught me things. I remember a sub called Derek coming up to me and saying, I'm going to teach you how to sub. I'm going to spend half an hour on you, and nobody's going to do it after that, so you better learn. Mm-hmm. That was focus, and I did learn. But I'm also very grateful to Derek for sparing that half an hour. And similarly, why did they put up to me? Because they knew I had what was needed, which I had world design knowledge at my fingertips, because I was running the showroom at Conran's in those days, and I also had my own textile company. I ran Conran Fabrics, and we had a mill in Manchester with our partners. We would specialise in special designs for aircraft and airports and hotels and hospitals. We would design something until the architect liked what we'd designed, and then we would guarantee to beat anyone else on price.
Wow.
So, yes.
Good idea.
It was very nice, but particularly it meant you were working on very exciting projects. When I was 27, I was doing fabrics for an entire fleet of aircraft. Me and my assistant, we had trouble. We always tried to make ourselves look older.
Those were the days when looking older was better, whereas now people want youth.
Well, nobody was going to entrust their aircraft to you if you looked as if you'd just come out of school. And I made my assistant wear glasses when he didn't need them. I tried to get him to grow a beard, but he rebelled. He did grow a beard in the end, yes. I think he still got it.
Maybe he couldn't grow a beard. You know how some people can't.
He was 19, yes.
So you were working then? You hadn't had children by then, had
yes,
you?
Yes, I had.
You had.
So my son, eldest son, was a honeymoon baby.
Oh.
And in those days, you know, there was no pill.
Yes.
So...
So
there was no choice,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would have done anyway. I mean, yeah. I originally wanted 4 children, and that's what everybody in my class at school did. We didn't say so. That was just what was expected of us, 4 children each. But I think I did manage very nicely, I think, with 2 children. But being a one-parent mother, I do not think I could have done it with 3 children.
No,
I think
really.
I would have just buckled at the knees and...
Yeah.
And not had the good time that I did.
You had a honeymoon baby, then you went back to work. And how normal was that? Because you were meant to give up work once you got married.
It was very much disapproved of. And I didn't really have much choice. With both my children, I never expected to work after them. But I was needed in the business. I really didn't like leaving the children so young, especially Jasper. I was needed on the furniture exhibition when he was a month old and my milk dried up and, there were dramas. But on the other hand, I think in those days, everybody criticised you and you couldn't get a nanny. You couldn't get a northern nanny if you were a working mother. If you could, not that we could have paid for it anyway, but what we had was an au pair girl.
Well, literally, there was a rule. If you're a working mother, you can't
employ... Yes, I tried to get a Norland nanny, so that would have been in about 1959. I tried to get a Norland nanny around 1960 for Jasper, but I was not allowed to. We did have a proper nanny at one point, and she was called Miss Fox, and she had been a nanny to Hayley Mills. And we couldn't stand her. And after a very short time, she left because she couldn't stand us. So, and also, she said Jasper peeped through the door when she was changing her stays. And
maybe that's
where
he got his ideas for designing.
I said, Jasper would never do a thing like that. And later he told me that he did.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I was very lucky in my au pairs. I had simply marvellous girls. And you have to understand that they were aged 17 and 18, and they didn't really want to come to England to look after somebody else's baby. They wanted to come to England to learn English.
And get on with boys.
Yes, but I only had one bad experience. And
you're lucky.
Yes, I was very lucky indeed.
Yeah, really.
And we really enjoyed our au pair girls.
Why did you divorce from Terence?
Oh, well, because... because of infidelity, he had an affair with his secretary and he would not talk to me about it. And everybody knew about it. And we got divorced. He still hasn't talked to me about it.
Ever.
And I think women can be called nags. This is quite often perhaps because if you want to talk to a man about something and he refuses to talk to you, then you go on trying and get branded a nag. So, I mean, I gave it a good shot. And, of course, since I've thought, did I do the right thing? You know, you live with guilt about the children, not about myself. I don't regret that for 1 minute.
So did they see their dad when they were growing up?
Not much. But on the other hand, they now both have a very good relationship with him. And they're very good designers, both of them.
They're
so
really talented.
Yes.
Yeah,
so can't complain.
No, I suppose both sides. We can't do anything else, can they?
And also, I had so much envied Yves Saint Laurent's mother when I was for a short time fashion editor of The Observer, because Yves Saint Laurent's mother got all the Yves Saint Laurent clothes.
Oh, wow.
And then Jasper grew up and I found I was Madame Saint Laurent as well. When Jasper grew up, I was in the happy position of being in the same position as Yves Saint Laurent's mother.
Because you both had success exactly the same time. You'd done Superwoman, that had caused massive stirs. But then your book was 80s, and his heyday was the 80s, wasn't it, really, for his design?
Jasper?
Yeah.
Yes, undoubtedly,
yes.
And that was when he dressed Princess Diana. He did come to me once and say, Mum, I no longer want to design clothes for women. And I said, well, that's all right. This is after he'd done it for about 20 years. Mm. I hoped that it would pass because Jasper's clothes are so practical. You know, he always has a pocket in everything and he can make your bum look two sizes smaller. And in other many respects, he's very practical about everything he designs. And like me, in a way, he has to see that it works empirically, that the knickers can be sat down in and that the dress can be danced in. His staff have to try these things out.
So that must be why he's so successful.
Now, I think it is one of the reasons. He grew up with women, but he's always been able to do things in the house, paint it, clean it, sweep it. You know, he's very, very good, very hands-on in the house.
You brought him up to be a superwoman.
Well, so, they both can. My daughter-in-law was amazed to find that Sebastian could sew on his own shirt buttons.
I know, I was so impressed with that. When I read that you always had a sewing kit on top of the telly and people had to do it themselves.
Yes.
Wow, that to me, that's impressive, Is it true that you got ME?
Yes, I got ME when I was a woman's editor of the Daily Mail and we had just started Female as a separate little 16-page magazine. And it was a howling success.
Still is. I love it. I love Female.
And then I got ME, and the Daily Mail were utterly wonderful to me about it. And they said they would wait for me till I was better, but I didn't think they had 40 years in mind. I find that they treat their staff extremely well.
Yes. Did anyone know about ME? You know, what were the symptoms?
No, that was very difficult because worse than having the illness, which people say it's fatigue syndrome. It's not that. You cannot get up. At one point, I was crawling on the floor to get the telephone, I remember, so the telephone had to be on the floor. And to have the doctor say, yes, well, we've tested you and you're perfectly okay, therefore go to this specialist, and you go to the specialist and realise immediately that it's a psychiatrist. And in those days, that meant you were mad. And I went to three, and the first one said that I was work shy. Well, anybody who knows our family knows they're not, because they, on the whole, have absolutely terrific work. And the second one said I was trying to seek attention. Well, if you're woman's editor of the Daily Mail, you have a great pile of invitations on your desk every morning. In fact, you don't even look at them. Your secretary weeds out the things you might fancy going to.
Fabulous.
So I knew he was useless. There was a third one that is equally useless. And then the fourth one said to me, we will treat everything you say as truthful. Now, that's very interesting. He didn't say he believed it. He said, we will treat everything you say as truthful. And he was called Dr. Gould, and he was head of psychiatry at Barts Hospital. And he was amazingly helpful to me generally, not only of the ME, but in my life generally, because he was so pro-women. Mm. And he also treated Mary Quant for her shyness, and she was a great friend of mine. Mary never said much. We've known each other since we started out as ex-students in London. And the only way I knew that Mary liked me was she used to give me fabulous presents, but she said very little. And she did have the problem, but Dr. Gould disposed of that very quickly.
Lovely.
And he also, what he encouraged in his patients was self-confidence. But I'd already worked out that I was ill, that the doctors... Mm-hmm. I sat down on the floor with a mug of tea and I thought, there's nothing wrong with my head. Therefore, I have something. I didn't know it was ME, and
no,
I didn't know...
Had it got a name then?
No, it didn't for a long time. No. But 250,000 people in Britain now have ME, and it's very difficult for their friends and family to understand, and I'm just grateful I'm not married, because ME is so unpredictable. Mm. You know, my life is a series of cancelled last-minute engagements, and luckily my friends...
You?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Have you got better? Have you got worse?
I think I'm pretty well about the same, but I manage it better.
Yes, you've learned. Yeah. You know you know the rules, you know your limitations.
You also know that you had better pay attention when it strikes, because you just have to cancel everything, dump everything, go to bed in a darkened room and it might be a week, it might be longer, until you feel better.
Are there any drugs you can take for it? You know, have you tried herbal, alternative? What have you tried?
Believe me, I've got the money. I've tried everything. I think the easiest thing I did was to recognise that I had this.
Yeah.
I did not know when I was going to stop having it, if ever.
Yeah.
Accept it.
Yeah, accept it.
Deal
yeah.
with it. Mm-hmm. And really, where ME is concerned, you have to let it deal with you. You have to be obedient to your ME. But then you learn. I'm doing a demo at the Sunday Times Festival of Education next week. Now, that's a 40-minute demonstration in front of a big audience. I will stay in bed all Sunday, and I will do nothing in that time,
mm-hmm.
Especially not television, which is quite exhausting for people with... For
anyone.
Me, anyway.
Yeah.
Don't think that sitting in front of a television is relaxing. It is quite tiring.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous Lives, Living Gorgeously.
It had a name, myeloencephalitis, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't learn it. I just call it ME.
Yeah.
But doctors don't accept that. And they insist on calling it fatigue syndrome, which really enrages anybody with ME because it so demeans it and diminishes it. What we've got is far more difficult to deal with than that. Having chronic fatigue syndrome sounds as if you need to just lie on the sofa for an hour or two and you'll feel better and less faint. It's not like that at all. I'm very lucky because I don't have pain, touch wood. To date, anyway.
So because of this, you stopped at the Daily Mail and you wrote Superwoman. And Superwoman was first published in 1975?
Yes, well, I hadn't had done any housework until I got ME. And then I couldn't afford anyone to do the housework. And, of course, that was a time when we really suffered because I wasn't earning for a period. I wrote Superwoman. I didn't mean to write it at all. I just, because I couldn't afford anybody to do my housework, I had to do it myself. And so I had to find out how to do it, and I went down to a bookshop to buy a book on how to clean your house, and I found they'd all cribbed from the one before. They were all like porridge to read, right back to Mrs. Beaton, and she had cribbed from Eliza Acton. So I thought, well, I'd better start making notes myself. And one day, somebody who'd been European editor of the Observer when I was there phoned me up. His name was Patrick Seal, and he had just decided to be an agent. And he phoned me up and said, Shirley, I've sold your book. I said, what book? He said, your book on housework. I said, I'm not writing a book on housework, Patrick. I told you I was writing notes to keep myself informed. He said, I've got the check in my pocket. I said, I'm writing a book.
Brilliant.
And we existed because of that advance, and it was the reason the publisher wanted the book, I found out later, was because the editor-in-chief had just got divorced and he wanted a book on how to do housework, and he'd found, like me, that there wasn't really a modern one.
What I love about this book is you pick it up and you think it's about housework, but the best thing is it's so witty because it says this is how not to do as minimal work as you can and to enjoy your life. It's a complete liberating book. It was the first feminist book really written by a woman in England, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I think liberating women from housework is possibly more useful than any other way of liberating them. But I was very much attacked by feminists at the time.
It's the opposite. You're absolutely helping women. It's a self-help book as well.
Yes.
And you're saying to them, look, you can do these shortcuts. You can have hobbies. You can get educated. There's even a section, it's called Sex Maniacs, and it deals with rape. I mean, that was so incredibly forward-thinking.
It was also, not only did it deal with rape, but it also dealt with dirty phone calls, which were just sort of starting to be popular at the time, and women didn't know how to deal with them. And there was also another chapter in there on stress, and I had a hard fight with the publisher because he said, women won't know what stress is. Well, that was in 1975, and by goodness, they do know now.
Yeah.
So, and there was another on noise problems. Also, I went to the top. I went to St. Thomas's Hospital to find out how to avoid injuring yourself while doing housework and the correct position you should be in to make a bed or how to pick something up off the floor, such as a child, without putting too much stress on your back. And I had diagrams in there. And the specialist I saw was totally bemused. He said, but why do you think women will take any notice of something in a book? And I thought, well, I hope they do. Every book I see, I think that has probably taken 2 years of somebody's sweat to produce it. So, as you can see by looking at the walls around my living room, all my walls are covered in books. And I think, although I'm mad about the iPad, I will always be a bookworm.
Did it cause a revolution, this book? Did you make money? You know, what happened?
I never made money with Superwoman because I had been making a note of how much things had cost, which it cost several thousand pounds to produce, which was big money back in 1975. And I borrowed against the house to do it.
Wow, that's such a risk.
I had bought the house with my own earnings. Superwoman didn't really make me any money because tax at the time was 83%.
Yes.
And it's very tough to think that the government is helping themselves to out of your purse to £83, leaving only £17 in there for you. Lace made a record-breaking sum. It was $750,000. It sold for a first novel, the record for Europe was. And then with the film rights, that made $1 million. So it was the magic number. But I found, sadly, that... of course, other writers didn't like to hear about the money. The publishers publicised it, not me. I knew too many writers who were struggling to make a living, and I didn't want to be seen as the person who just swanned in, made £1 million and swanned off again.
The thing is, you hadn't, because Lace is an experience. It's all your life experiences brought together into a book. And it was created by you because you wanted women to be empowered through their sexuality. You wanted women to be able to say, that man's no good in bed and I'm going to go and find another man that can do it, or I'm going to play with myself, or I'm going to, you know, it was all about, again, it was a clever way of getting to women without them knowing it.
Yes.
Again, you were educating them.
Yeah. What I really wanted to do was write a book for teenage girls about sex, and I put in about 18 months research on this. And if I had a big interview and I was paying for it, I would take another journalist along with me. Her job was at the end of the interview to say, to remind me of the questions I'd forgotten, and she'd say, Shirley, weren't you going to ask about this, about that? And then afterwards we'd go off and discuss it. There was a particularly striking interview. I was with the leading female sex doctor of the time in Britain, and she happened to mention, you plea through your clitoris. So me and my journalist friend Maleva, you can hear us both leaning forward and saying, eh?
Yeah.
On the two tape recordings. And she repeated it, you pee through your clitoris. And she said, looking at our faces, a bit annoyed, she said, well, if you don't believe me, you can go and check with Grey's Anatomy. So that's exactly what we did after the interview, and we found that Grey was right and she was wrong.
Yeah.
At that point, I thought, my audience has got to be teenage girls, but I've got to work out how to reach them. Now, in my youth, there was a banned book called Forever Amber, which is what would be called a bodice ripper.
I've read it. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And it was passed around school in a wrapper of When We Were Very Young. So I thought, what's really needed is a racy book. And it was my first novel, and I'd always wanted to write a novel. I held myself up, and it took 18 months to do it. It was relatively easy to write because I didn't have to invent anything. But 90% of Lace is true. Even the prince in it is based on a real king. The King of Jordan fell in love with my best friend when we were both 19, and so for 2 years I would go along as her lady-in-waiting and chaperone, which is fairly laughable.
Yeah.
But, you know, the plot is not true, but the people in it are real people, and I'm happy to say that I've had wonderful relationships with women throughout my life. My women friends have been stunningly good to me and helpful, and I hope I've been the same to them.
Over 1,000 followers can't be wrong. Follow us on @radio_gorgeous on Twitter, darling, of course. Mwah. Now I'm going to read out the bit that made me laugh so much. This is about orgasms.
The book starts with a group of girls in a finishing school in Switzerland in 1947, which is, funnily enough, where I happened to be in 1947. So it's really based on my experiences at the school.
None of them had explored, felt or seen the area between their legs. None of them had heard of masturbation or knew they had already experienced it. The 14-year-old Maxine, bored and wriggling on a chair during scripture class, thought she had experienced religious ecstasy. Pagan, hunting on a borrowed mount with an unusually high-fronted saddle, had once felt exalted and what she thought was a divine thrill of the chase. Kate has always loved climbing ropes in a gym class because of a lovely, tickly sort of itch you got when, having pulled yourself up over your arm, you slid down the rope with your legs around it, thighs tense and descent controlled by your feet acting as brakes. Once you'd have the feeling right at the top of the rope and hung there swaying, blissfully frozen, unable to move and heedless of the cross-clipped voice of Miss Haydock, the instructor's, who was used to girls being frozen on the top of ropes, telling Kate to come down immediately. I thought that was just so brilliant. Then the other thing I wanted to read was they are just talking about exploring, down there and about how far you should go with a man. Because obviously their sexuality, they're just beginning to come out.
So it's schoolgirls discussing this after lights out in the dorm.
Which is the most fun in life, as we know. A certain sort of girl allowed the man to go below the waist, in which case there were two subdivisions, were one above and two below the underclothes, but with his thing firmly zipped up, you understand. But what happens under the underclothes? The boy strokes the fur. There was a further silence, while in the dark they all furtively stroked their pubic hair and felt nothing. The seventh stage of wickedness was letting a boy go all the way. Going all the way would be ecstasy, of course, but it would also be dreadfully dangerous. Yeah. And of course it was, as you say, there wasn't the pill then. But it seems like you did. Did you all lose your virginity, in Switzerland?
Well, what I looked for was, I did a lot of interviews, as you can imagine, with medical people, but I also interviewed women, because there are four, as I see it, four areas of possibility, which is either you come like a pop gun when anybody puts his penis inside you. These are fairly rare. Yeah. Or you're not particularly interested in sex, and you probably don't have orgasms, although you think you might have done. You're not sure. Then there's somebody who can really only achieve orgasm if the wind is in the right direction and it's a Tuesday evening and so on. me too, yeah. And then there are two sorts of actual orgasm, an interior, a vaginal orgasm and a clitoral orgasm, although all orgasms stem from the clitoris. And so I went on interviewing people till I had interviewed four different types of women. And these people were not my friends. And they have never said a word or claimed to have written this, which 17 other people claimed to have done. And I have never said who they were. And I'm still very grateful to them, because to talk about sex to a stranger in those days, or even to talk about sex to your mother, was very difficult, if not impossible. As I'm explaining to you, LACE was built on a fairly well worked out system related to sex instruction. But luckily it didn't show.
No. I really thought what I really related to was the time when they often all did it for the first time and sat there with kind of the spunk dripping down their legs, and they felt deflated, because you thought, what was that all about? You know what I mean? Because it isn't as good as you imagine it. It's everything leading up to it is the best bit, really.
And certainly not the first time. I think they thought, is that all there is? Then they thought, there must be something wrong with me. Because women so often blame themselves in a situation where they don't trust their own instincts. And I think that is one of the things that's holding women back.
And I still think your book is so relevant now.
Yes.
You know, it's you know, the message is still so strong, and I'm really keen on getting my daughter, who's 17, to read it.
Oh, I'm surprised she hadn't read it when she was 12.
I think,
too, that Lace is about, somebody says, it's a career advisory book. In a way, it is, because I put in what I'd known about making it in newspapers, about making it as an interior designer, about making it as a businesswoman. And I think that's enough. I can't remember any more at the moment. But they all had career. Oh, I know, making it in fashion.
Yes.
And, of course, I knew that from Jasper's experience.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, but
Jasper's
detail.
In the book. He's called...
Oh, yeah, which one?
Yeah, he's called Guy Saint-Simon.
Oh, yes, he's the one who's living in Paris.
Yeah.
Fabulous. In 1998, you founded Mothers in Management,
yes.
which aimed to improve working conditions for parents.
Yeah.
In 2001, you founded the Work-Life Balance Trust.
I founded Mothers in Management. Mm. A nice man called Lord Stevenson took me on one side and said, look, you'll never get it from the men if you ask for it for women alone. Ask for it for the men as well. He said, and changed the title. So I changed the title from Mothers in Management to the Work-Life Balance Trust, which was a registered charity, and which it had then been brought to my attention that there were a lot of men who... had a difficult time. If you were a lone parent and had your old father to look after and he was incontinent and you didn't like to mention it at work. So the aim of the Work-Life Balance Trust was to introduce flexi hours to the workplace and make them acceptable, which it did. It was part of the three manifestos for an election, and I had to brief at ministerial level on the three different parties. So I thought this was a wonderful excuse to chuck it in, stop paying for it with my own money, and although we had many, many donations, and generally sort of say job done. The other reason I wound up the Work-Life Balance Trust was because it was a very small group of women and men. There were only about 12 of us, and it was understood that at any time you could take 6 months off without saying why, if your circumstances were difficult. And they all had full-time jobs except me. I worked on it full-time, but I wasn't employed. And on Work-Life Balance Week, they had to take time off from their holiday time. So I thought, I just sensed I didn't want people to start falling away, and I thought 6 years is a long time for somebody to have put in as voluntary work.
Yeah.
But, of course, so we finished on the crest of the wave.
Fabulous. Also, you were taking away, if they're meant to be on holiday, you're taking away their work-life balance, which was quite...
I'm afraid that never occurred to me at the time. When we called it the Work-Life Balance Trust, it is a damn difficult name to remember. So why did we do that? Because the second you say, what does it mean? The second you hear it and think about it, you immediately ask yourself, have I got it? And the answer is always no. So then you understand what it's about. Really, it's about being able to control your own life and not be swamped by work life and home life with children.
Then you were awarded the OBE.
Oh, yes, that was a great day. It was the first award for equality, which I was very pleased about, as you could imagine. So we all went off to the palace, and in the grand ballroom, I had my medal pinned on me by Princess Anne, and she was, I think she's a very admirable person.
Yes,
and
she's always a practical woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Buys her underwear from Marks and Spencer's, you know, just like the rest of us really, except for one or two things. And as she pinned it onto me, she said, this is in a different direction for you, isn't it? What about Lace? So I said, well, that's still going strong, ma'am, but as you said, it's a different direction and life takes different directions.
That means she's definitely read it.
Yeah. It's all about helping women, and it started from my divorce from Terence. And at that moment, I realised that I just wanted to help women from that moment on, and I hope that I have done.
I think you really have. Shirley Conran, thank you so much for coming onto Radio Gorgeous.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Gorgeous Lives was brought to you by Radio Gorgeous Productions. For more information about Gorgeous Lives or more Gorgeous Lives, go to radiogorgeous.com.
Radio Gorgeous.